Hello and welcome to the Hill Times Hot Room Podcast. I am your host, Peter Mazaru. On this week's episode, we're going to explore a polling technique that has been growing in popularity and could change how political parties and the groups that try to influence them do their work. MRP polling. What is it? How does it work? What can it do? To answer those questions, I'll be speaking with David Coletto. Coletto is the CEO of Abacus Data, a polling firm that recently launched an MRP service for its customers. That interview is coming up after the break, but first, your look at the week ahead in Canadian politics. Parliament will get back to business on Monday, following a break week that has just wrapped up. Also on Monday, Industry Minister François-Philippe Champagne will testify before a Commons committee studying government-funded university research projects with connections to China. Finance Minister Chrystia Freeland will own many of the headlines early this week. She's planning to release her fall fiscal update on Tuesday afternoon. The update will provide the government's most up-to-date projections for its own finances and the near future of the Canadian economy. It may or may not include new government spending measures as well. On Wednesday afternoon, farmers are planning to hold a rally on Parliament Hill to protest what their organizers say has been a massive purchase of farmland over the years by investment firms, driving up prices. Also on Wednesday, Bank of Canada Governor Tiff Macklem will deliver a speech on the cost of high inflation to the St. John Chamber of Commerce. And the Assembly of First Nations will hold a virtual summit on water and wastewater, which is expected to draw Indigenous leaders and government officials. Activists concerned about nuclear weapons and youth issues are also planning separate events in Ottawa this week. On Thursday and Friday, Prime Minister Justin Trudeau will host a summit of political leaders from Canada and the European Union in St. John's. Throughout this week, the CRTC will hold hearings in Gatineau about how rules and regulations around Canadian content should be updated. Finally, Statistics Canada is planning to release new data this week on investment in building construction, the prices of goods and housing, labor market participation of parents with young children, and more. There's your week ahead in politics. Now, on to my interview with David Coletto. Okay, we're back with David Coletto of Abacus Data. David, thanks for coming on the podcast.
Great to be here. Thanks for having me.
So you have described MRP polling as a game-changing tool for government relations, advocacy. What is MRP polling?
Yeah, so it is basically a statistical technique that we can use that combines two things. So anyone who's taken a social science or any research methods or stats class may understand what I'm about to say, but it involves multiple regression, which is an advanced statistical method, and post stratification, which is a way of sort of adjusting data. And the basic premise is it's a technique that estimates the relationship between a variety of characteristics of a person, where they live, their demographic profile, some socioeconomic stuff, even some of their opinions, and basically looks at an outcome. In this case, we'll probably talk most about voting, and looks at the relationship between all those variables and their likelihood to vote for the Conservatives, the Liberals, the NDP, or not vote at all, and then aggregates that all up and overlays it onto census data so that it allows us to actually project where people are most likely to be voting conservative and where they're most likely to be voting liberal based on that model. So it requires a large national survey to do it, but it's proven to be as accurate, if not more accurate, than other methods at projecting seats in a system like Canada or the UK or the US. And I think being able to basically replace riding level surveys and tell those that are building advocacy campaigns, those that need content for lobby days, what constituents in all those 338 ridings think about a particular issue or set of issues.
And so we're clear, which of those steps are not being done in a conventional poll?
The second part. So the tool you need to do this is the poll. So, you know, we have polling out there. You need a larger sample than is typically done. So, you know, we kind of set the stage that we need at least 3,000 to 4,000 person sample nationally to be able to do this really well. So that anybody can do. And we regularly are interviewing like 2,200 to 2,300 people in our national surveys. So we can increase that sample size. But the step that's not being done is taking census data that already exists, that we know where people live by any geographic configuration, whether that be the riding, whether that be the census district, the municipality, even the FSA, the first three digits of your postal code, and applying the survey data and what we learn from that survey data and the relationships that survey data tells us about people and their opinions or people and their vote, and apply and basically model it on that census data. So it's that second step that's new and makes it a very powerful tool, because the census data is almost perfect in the sense of there's very little error in it. We know there's error in survey data, and so it helps correct for that and allows us to remove any kind of assumptions in the modeling on voting in particular.
So is the idea that you can safely predict over a large sample size that a person is likely to behave in a particular way, for example, who they're going to vote for, based on certain characteristics, age, gender, education level?
Yeah, let me give you an example. Let's say we know that in our survey that somebody who is male, aged 65, lives in rural Alberta, makes middle income, has a high school education, and has voted conservative the last three elections or even the last election. The model basically says, what's the likelihood that person's going to vote conservative again, and gives it a probability, and then applies that probability to other liked people like that one individual and where they live across the country or in Alberta in that case. So it's basically modeling the likelihood to vote for certain parties or to have a certain opinion about something, and then knowing that the census data has millions of data points allows us to find out where that person also is like to live, like people are likely living, and project that onto the map.
And so using the example you just gave of that kind of a person, what would you have to do to predict how that person is likely to vote using traditional polling methods?
Well, we know that, not a lot of pollsters do this kind of advanced kind of prediction at the micro level, where we're taking our individual responses to surveys and saying, okay, here are the factors that most predict how somebody's going to vote. Political scientists do that often after elections when they're looking at, what were the factors that most affected, people's voting behavior. What we're doing normally, or what I don't do seat projections until I did this, but what other pollsters and the Eric Greniers and Philippe Fourniers of the world are doing is they're taking polling data at the aggregate level, whether that be national or regional numbers, and then looking at how elections were in the last election and applying some kind of swing model to say, well, if in Etobicoke Center, for example, the Liberals got, I don't know what it was, but let's say 45% of the vote in 2021, but Now in Ontario or in the GTA region, the Liberals are down 5 points. Their model takes into account that kind of swing and then projects how that riding might go. MRP does not do that. It doesn't assume that the way people are voting today is entirely driven by the way they voted in the past. It's one variable on top of a whole others. And the value of it, particularly when we're seeing, as we I think we are now, substantial changes in people's vote intention, where we are seeing, I think, some realignment in the electorate, that it is perhaps, and we'll see once we get closer to the election and is actually tested, it could produce more accurate results. And the evidence from other countries, where in the UK, where it's probably used most publicly, is that in the 2017 UK general election, that was an election in which Theresa May, the Prime Minister, the Conservative Prime Minister, called an early election, thinking she was going to win a big, big majority and allowed her to push through Brexit. It was MRP halfway through that campaign done by a company called YouGov that signaled, well, wait a second, this might actually turn into a minority government or a hung parliament, as they say in the UK. And that was different from the conclusions that people were making from the traditional polls numbers that were being put out there.
I'm glad you mentioned Etobicoke, because if you can explain Etobicoke politics to me using this technique, for listeners who don't know, Etobicoke is the heart of Ford Nation. It is all progressive conservative provincially and all liberal federally, and has been something of a mystery to me. So how do you figure out how to weigh these different data points? For example, you have someone, you know that there's a person living in a riding with this socioeconomic status, this gender, this age, maybe they voted a certain way last time, et cetera, all these data points. How do you know how to balance them in a way that will let you predict which way they're going to vote?
Well, that's what regression analysis actually does for us. It's telling us how important each of these variables are in terms of predicting someone's vote. And then if we know those variables, right? So regression will tell us that, let's say, and it's different dependent on and where people live and a number of variables. It's highly complex, but let's just say we know that, for simplicity's sake, that someone's age helps explain 10% of the reason they might be voting a certain way, right? Then we've tried to find, okay, what else gets us to as close to 100% of the variance, as we say, in what predicts someone's voting behavior. The closer we get to 100, the more certain we are we can, with the right data, predict how that some person's going to vote. And then what we do is it's basically creating a formula that if we plug in all of the different variables, how old somebody is, are they male, female, or non-binary, where do they live, how much money do they make, how did they vote last time, did they vote at all, are they likely to vote this time? And you add those all up and it will then produce a score that says this person is likely to vote conservative, this person is likely to vote liberal. And you aggregate that all up over the course of this 5,000-6,000 cases we have in a survey and apply it to the actual population. So it may be that weighting might be different depending on what part of the country or certain demographics. But what this full model does is it gives us at any given moment, what are the variables that are likely to predict voting behavior? And then we can actually model it out and we can create predictions about how people would likely vote today based on the survey data that we plug into the model.
Now, you mentioned relying on census data, which you can get broken down by riding. The ridings are going to change, I believe, before the next election.
Yeah.
How do you account for that?
So we've already accounted for that. So we already know, and there's already been the transposition done of what the new 343 ridings will be and the boundaries that they have, and then where the previous census breakout falls into that. So the projections that we made earlier this week that we put out that said the Conservatives are going to win 204 seats are based on the new map, the 343 seats. So we're already kind of anticipating what the next parliament does, but we could apply it to the current map as well, which we haven't done right now. We're still working on that.
How does this account for voter turnout, which is notoriously hard for pollsters to get a grasp on?
It does. So we know the voter turnout for each riding, and that becomes a variable. Basically, another aspect of this that's really powerful is it's what we call a multi-level model. So we take into account two levels of information, right? The what I call the micro level, the individual voter that we're interviewing on our survey. We know a whole bunch of things about them because the survey data asks them demographics, socioeconomic, their vote, their opinions. But then we also know where they live. And where they live, we know, has an impact on how we vote and how we think about the world. And so we append on this second level of data about the constituency, what was the turnout in that constituency in the last election. We can start adding on how close was the election and how has it been in the past. And all of that increases the our predictive power at estimating the likelihood that that person's going to vote and the likelihood that that person is going to vote a certain way if they do vote. And so, yeah, turnout is definitely embedded into the model. And what we're trying to work on now, as we get closer to election, I think it becomes more important, is not just how was turnout in the past, but what's the likely turnout going to be in the future. And so we're including questions on our survey now asking people, well, if an election were today, how likely would you vote on a scale from 0 to 10, for example? And that's going to help us understand motivation across different partisan supporters.
Do you usually see a strong relationship in your polling between whether someone says they're going to vote and whether they actually end up voting?
Well, it's hard for us to know because we don't have access like some states in the U.S. where you actually, there's public records of whether somebody voted or not. We don't have access to that. So we can't verify how accurate that is. And there's, you know, pollsters have tried in Canada in the past to try to, you know, do likely voter models and, you know, Abacus has done it in the last few elections we've polled in, where we're actually in the final days of the campaign, we just isolate those who say they're, you know, most likely to vote. And my experience is it does improve the accuracy of the estimate. And so I suspect, and the MRP models that are being done in the UK apply that as well, and it produces more accurate results. So I think we need some measure of enthusiasm because we know not everybody's going to vote, and we know that an election and at a period of time, some voters will be more enthusiastic than others, right? Like, I think we can pretty much make the hypothesis, Peter, that right now, conservative-oriented voters really excited will probably be more likely to vote. And at least right now, I think liberal-oriented voters less enthused. But that doesn't mean they won't become that if the election becomes highly polarized and they feel motivated to go out and vote. So it's important for us to measure that and also to measure that over time across different groups and types of voters.
Right. Because, of course, voter turnout, from what I've heard, that can swing right up until the last minute of an election.
Yeah. Something happens in a campaign that gets people excited or depresses them. Like, and I say depressed, I mean, like, makes them not excited to go vote. Think of a leader's debate that, you know, there's a knockout punch or something in that, or the frame of the election or an issue or a photo of a prime minister wearing blackface emerges. Like, all things can happen during a campaign that might make some voters more excited, more enthusiastic to vote, and others less so.
There's some similarity to my sort of untrained brain between what you're describing and what I've heard about how, say, Facebook sells ads to advertisers. You know, collect a bunch of demographic and data about your interests, paint a little picture of each user, and then figure out what products are they likely to buy and what ads do they want to see. Is there any similarity to how it works?
It is. It's basically an algorithm, right? It's Facebook is trying to determine the likelihood that you, let's say, are a dog owner, even if they don't know whether you're a dog owner or not. They probably have enough data to demonstrate, like, based on if they've got, like, the photos you're posting and the things you're looking at. And I don't know, you know, if they're listening to us, what you're talking about, they can then, with some certainty, they hope, produce an estimate of who you are and what you like and what you do in your day-to-day life. We're you know, we're basically doing the same thing, but we're actually asking people for this information. So it's a little less kind of nefarious, as some people might feel, like people don't have to answer our surveys. But it's the basic idea is we are trying to increase the likelihood we know, based on both theory and the data, that somebody's going to vote a certain way or vote at all. And the more information we have about that person, not just who they are, but where they live, the more likely we are to predict that outcome. And so, yeah, that algorithm, that notion of an algorithm is fundamental to regression. And that's what regression analysis is basically about. And it's used in multiple applications in consumer behavioral research and trying to get you to buy a certain thing, to, as you said, even displaying ads to you on social media platforms.
How might lobby or interest groups make use of MRP polling?
Well, this is what I'm most excited about, because like I don't do partisan work, so I'm not going to go work for a political party and do this. But it's actually, if you're an association and you're about to do a lobby day, right? Or you're trying to demonstrate to members of parliament that the public supports an idea or wants you to do something. You know, you may in the past been able to do some riding surveys. You may have done a national survey that you broke out different regions, but that MP, you know, inevitably comes back to you and says, well, what do my constituents think? That's what they're wondering. That's all they really care about. And so what we're able to do with this methodology is basically, you know, create 338 reports on what constituents think about different issues, right? And it's particularly important and powerful if we know and we anticipate that people living in different parts of the country in different ridings are going to have different views of something. So you can actually go to an MP and say, with pretty good certainty, we believe that X percent of your constituents believe X or Y, believe this or that. And right now, no association can barely afford to do 5 riding level polls, let alone 338. And the second reason I think it's so important is I think it's in the next few years, it's going to be actually impossible to do riding level surveys, because response rates are dropping so rapidly to telephone surveys. And that's right now really the only way that we can do that. So in the absence of our ability to know what's going on at a constituency level, MRP provides a really, I think, yeah, useful and powerful tool for lobbyists, for advocates, for campaigners, and even for those who are trying to target advertising at particular audiences. This is the way that sometimes you can take psychographic data and apply it to a geography, which is really hard to do in a traditional survey.
So the idea might be you do a national level survey, and then you look at, okay, these are the ridings that might be a close contest in the next election. And then you look at, out of those ridings, in which of them do a lot of people seem to really care about this issue? And then the interest group can take that to the MPs in those ridings and say, you ought to be paying attention to this. Is that the idea?
That's basically it, right? So you'd come to advocates and say, we want to do this. And we do a large national survey, which some of our clients do anyways. And you'd get the report that breaks out results by, you know, nationally and region and different demographics at the top aggregate level. But then you do the add-on and you say, but we want to produce however many reports for MPs in this region, or as you said, in swing seats, those that are going to be most decisive at the next election. And then we can produce basically individual reports on not all variables. You basically have to pick a 4 or 5 of the questions that are most important, because we have to basically run this model for every single question. But we can produce small reports that tell that MP what their constituents are thinking, and then the broader context of how that fits into the national story. So it's a really powerful tool for that.
I think that's all we have time for, David, but I'm sure there are a lot of people in the government relations and world of politics who are going to be interested to see how this turns out. Thanks for coming on the podcast.
Peter, thanks for having me.